Back to the Future was a great movie, Ron, wasn't it?
Oh, it was. I mean, it really, as I said, I love it. I have all the versions of it, and it's just a delight. I wanted to mention that if listeners are interested, that my book, Time Traveler, is available from Amazon.com.
Super. Well, they've got so many. They discount it, but they sell a lot, you know?
Yes.
They really do. And so are you hiding a flux capacitor any place in your house?
No, not quite. But I'll tell you, I wish it was as simple as that. I mean, but it's a little bit more sophisticated.
Get in your DeLorean and off you'd go.
Yeah.
That's the way to do it. Let's go to the calls, Ron. Lots of folks lining up to talk with you. Let's go to Dallas, Texas to get things started east of the Rockies. Steve, welcome to the show.
Hey, first I'd like to say thanks for giving me something to chew on, guys.
You got it.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And my next question is, if you're creating a gravitational field by rotating the, basically rotating the photons, how are you preventing the light from collapsing in on itself?
Well, the thing is that it depends on how intense it is. I mean, if a source of gravity is too strong, it will collapse. But prior to that, you can create a gravitational field that won't cause the photon to collapse on itself. It'll just simply create a gravitational field that will cause this twisting of space that I'm saying. In other words, for example, I was talking about bouncing light off of mirrors, but you can also use intersecting light beams to form, like, for example, a square by having four separate light beams. And you can create pretty good gravitational field over a very small region that won't collapse on itself. But if the source is too great, any source will eventually create a black hole. But prior to that, there's ways that that you can set up the configuration so that it won't.
Okay, thanks, Steve. Are there any other countries involved in time travel research?
That's a good question, because if they are, they aren't saying a lot about it, and they may be. There's not any countries that are obviously doing. I should say, and I should mention that there are other researchers besides myself who are looking at this process of time travel into the past, and I talk about that in more detail in my book. But there's, for example, people like Kip Thorne's people, and the people have been inspired by his work. And that work is based on what is known as using wormholes. You can use wormholes to create paths to the path. And then there's a work of a person like Richard Gott at Princeton, and his work is based on using what are known as cosmic strings. And these cosmic strings are configurations that occur in space that can actually create loops in time as well. So there's other research that's going on. As I said, I didn't talk mainly about that. And there's probably research that's going on in other countries, but as I said, if the governments are involved in it, they're not saying much about it.
Okay, next up, let's go to Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Robert on the wild card line. Hi, Robert.
Hi, how's it going?
All is well, thanks.
Well, I've been sitting here all night observing movies from the 1920s. On AMC, and I'm watching a movie right now from 1928, but I'm kind of curious. I just wonder if it's possible to use one of these really old movies to, say, travel back to the past.
It's interesting. When you're seeing an old movie, in a sense, it's like something that was capturing the past, and it's always fascinating to me because the fact that when you're watching a movie, especially from the 20s, you know, in a sense, you're almost like seeing ghosts because these people are no longer present with us. But by, you know, watching it, the film, you're actually seeing them alive again. But that's not real time travel in the sense that I'm talking about, where you actually can physically go back into the past. That's more like your memory in some sense. That is to say that your memory, when you go back into your past, and you are actually, by remembering something that's in your past, you're not actually traveling back to that time, but you're actually reliving an event that you remember from that time. And that's a different thing. Here in Einstein's theory, we're actually talking about physically traveling to the distant future or physically traveling back to the past. You would be the only one that was doing it because you would have the particular device to do it, but but you would be actually living in that time again, back in the past or in the future.
What do you like about your book the best, Time Traveler?
Well, what I like about it is best is the human side of the story. I mean, because the thing is that for me, it's taking people on a journey of adventure, both intellectual adventure, but also a personal adventure. So that aspect of it to me is to show, you know, how one learns, how one goes through this. And as I said, in the book, I don't sugarcoat the struggles and the personal things that I went through. And I'm really pleased with the fact that people respond to that, as well as the fact that I guide them. I let them learn with me. I don't say, in this chapter, we will. What I do is I actually allow people to actually grow and learn as I grew and learned, so that eventually when they come to the end of the journey in the book, they feel like they have traveled with me through time.
Okay, next up we go to Hemet, California, west of the Rockies. Dan, you're up with us. Go ahead, Daniel.
Yes. Hey, George.
Hi.
Nice to talk to you again.
You too.
Before I ask my question, have you heard whether the comet coming through on the 21st of October, this will be 11 million miles from the Earth. Is that confirmed that the tail will be so close it'll throw debris on the Earth?
I'm not sure about debris, but it's going to be pretty darn close. Ron, we've been monitoring this comet, Elenin.
Uh-huh. Okay, I have to admit, I hadn't been, so I didn't even realize it was going to be coming.
Yeah, I mean, it's some Richard Hoagland, by the way, Friday night when I'm live in Albuquerque, we'll talk a lot about that, so make sure you're listening.
And that planetary body that's following it could be Planet X. Has that been seen?
Not by traditional astronomers.
Uh-huh. Now, the question for your guest is he aware of any secret U.S. government time travel experiments? I've heard rumors back in 88, 89 era that they had something going called Project Mortimus, and if you mentioned it and the government found out you knew about it, they would eliminate you.
Wow.
Plus, also, in one of the Superman movies where he went back in time to save Lois Lane, when he started flying around, his idea of going through time is fly around the Earth real fast, either clockwise or counterclockwise, depending on which way he wants to go, you know. But in the movie, it says, the Godfather's appeared and says, it is forbidden. And the second part of the question to your guest is, do you think God would actually forbid time travel? And I'm done asking.
All right, well, let's talk about any secret government projects, Ron
right.
Allen.
That's an interesting thing. I think one of your guests was Jesse Ventura.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Right. Incidentally, I'm going to be on that show, by the way.
Good for you. Dan, tell him hi for us. He'll love
right.
you.
But the thing is that whether the government is involved or not, it's hard to say. But here is one of the things that you have to realize. Even with something as super secret as the atomic bomb project, there were leaks. And the thing is that these were credible leaks. And in fact, they led to the Russians, you know, to have a jump because of these leaks. The government is not really very good at keeping secrets. I mean, it's really an exaggeration. If there was this going on, we would find out. I mean, we would know. I mean, the government.
Somebody would leak it.
Right. The government is really not good at keeping secrets. Okay. So I highly suspect that it's not happening. The thing is that also, when I mentioned some of the experiments that we've taken, the baby steps into the future, I was mentioning this Halfel-Keating experiment. You know, science is based on repeatability and actually showing that you can actually do these things. And the thing is that I think that the government could be trying to develop a project. But as I said, I think we would know something about it. A secret would have been leaked by now. So I'm skeptical, but that doesn't mean that it can't be happening. But I'm just skeptical about that. Now, in your other question, and I need to point out that that I'm actually a believer. Okay, I want to make that clear because this is actually asked me by students whenever I'm giving lectures. The thing is that my personal belief is that we have this intellect that is part of God's design. And to me, if we don't use our intellect to its fullest, which was the purpose of giving us our intellect, that is flying in the face of God. I mean, it's like all of the things that we have, all the advances we have, flight, medicine, all of these things are developed because of our intellect. So to me, you know, if and when we do develop time travel, it will be because of the fact that we were meant to be able to develop it, or we wouldn't have this innate capacity to develop it. And I believe that whatever the human mind can conceive, it can and will achieve.
There's no doubt about that. It may not happen right away,
right?
But it will happen. Next up, let's go to San Antonio, Texas, first-time caller. Rick's with us. Go ahead, Rick.
Yes, Rick. Yes, George. This is. I just wanted to ask, as far as the scientific studies done with the two clocks in two different locations, how are they sure they actually accomplished time travel rather than maybe just the degradation of the efficiency of the clocks? And he had mentioned that the heart rate slows down in a person. And how do they know they just didn't measure or figure that traveling at the speed of light slows down the aging process?
The thing is that, remember what I said, that the hallmark of scientific development is the repeatability of an experiment. Just having one single experiment do that, you could have, in fact, as you state, there could be questions about it. In fact, that's the reason why it had to be repeated again. This experiment I was mentioning was just the initial experiment. The experiment has been repeated a number of times again with increasing accuracy. So that's the reason why one realized that, in other words, you can't just simply believe one data point. You have to actually repeat the experiment again. It has to be repeated independently by other researchers. And this experiment has been done independently by other researchers under different circumstances. And what they have found is that to even increasing accuracy, that the clocks slow down the faster they move.
How did H.G. Wells even conceive of time travel during that era?
You know, George, that has always been a wonder to me. That has always been, because the way in which if you read the original book, his discussion of it, of the notion of time as the fourth dimension and stating that explicitly, and the ideas and the way in which he puts it, it's uncanny. I mean, it really is uncanny. One almost is tempted to, and I was in fact involved in a documentary in which they played around with the notion that perhaps someone from the future, you know, had visited H.G. Wells. But once again, as I said, because of the nature of a time machine, it probably wasn't terrestrial that did it. But in any case, the thing is that it's just, I think it was because of, remember, as I said, Einstein said that imagination is more important than knowledge. And I think that it was H.G. Wells' imagination that was just so superior that he was able to see and think about the developments in his time and to conceive of this notion of time as a fourth dimension and being able to move along it by having a device. But it was a brilliant and uncanny thing, and it made his fortune. It was actually one of his most popular books, and it's the thing that actually put him on the literary map.
Let's go to Ocala, Florida. Chris, welcome to the program. You're on Coast to Coast. Hey, Chris.
Hi, George Norrie.
Hey.
Hi, Dr. Mallett. Hey, Dr. Mallett, I went to Penn State as well, and I'm also a believer in God.
Great.
So that makes us double brothers. So
wonderful.
Anyway, I'm listening to your show. I didn't get all of it, so I've been listening to it since like 2:30 my time. So you know, 3 hours ahead of you guys. But anyway, from what I gathered, your time machine you're talking about is it has to stay constant. So that way, say, for example, you want to send a message, say, from 2030 to our current time period, 2011. And however, though, the issue is if there's a cut in the power and electricity, it won't work. So in order for the time machine to actually work, you have to have a constant source of power that is your own power source, independent of the power source at UConn. Because, say,
right.
for example,
that's
you
a
have
very
to...
good point. The thing is that you would hope to have a backup because it would have to be continuous. That's a very important point. If there was a disruption in the power, then you would not be able to turn it on and get the message again. I mean, it would be gone. So you would actually have to keep the system on constantly, or you would not. That would be a very important issue. So one would have to have backups in order to make sure that you had the system stable and that the power source, allowed the light source to continue continuously.
What do you think Einstein would have been able to do had he had computers?
Well, the thing is that I think, this is interesting, I don't know that computers would have helped him that much. A lot of theoretical physics is done without computers. Where computers have become important is in the final number crunching, okay, and in developing complex models. But as far as developing inspirational ideas and the development of that, that really, computers don't really play that much a role. I should mention that in all the papers that I've written, in fact, the most recent ones showing about, you know, the effects of circulating light on gravity, have been done without a computer. And they were very, very sophisticated equations, but that's because of the fact that I love to be in the equation. I love to have my hands, you might say, in there. I like the physical feel of the equations themselves, because that, in a sense, it's like painting. One could have a machine paint, but it's a whole different experience when you're in there painting yourself. And so for me, a theoretical physicist is like, a painter of equations. And to me, to really understand what's going on, it's important to be in there and doing the calculations yourself. But of course, when you're doing the final numbers, that's something where the computer is useful. So I think that for Einstein, the computers would not have been that much more of a help. I really think that it was something that had to, that required his imagination. Where Einstein ran into a problem, ultimately, when he was trying to develop his unified field theory, was the fact that he didn't take into account enough of the physics that was going on around him. So even with a sophisticated computer, without taking into account a lot of what was going on in quantum physics, that's ultimately what allowed him not to succeed in his ultimate goal of the unified field theory.
Ron, we're going to come back and take some final phone calls with you on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, final segment here with Professor Ron Mallett. We're talking about his work, Time Traveler, a scientist's personal mission to make time travel a reality. How disappointed will you be, Ron, if you cannot go back into time?
Actually, very.
This has been your whole motivation, hasn't it?
Well, the thing is that you have to remember that I actually have this, it's a faith based on science. It's based on the belief that Einstein's general theory of relativity is correct, and it's actually been shown to be correct in the experiments that have been done. So to me, it would be disappointing, but nevertheless, I do believe that it will happen. And it would be nice in my lifetime if I actually see us going back into the past, but if I can just simply see the first steps of it. As I said, for me, part of what I do as a teacher is to inspire the young. So if I can be seen as the pioneer in the beginning of it, and eventually it happens in another generation, and that's the other thing exciting for me about writing a book. Someday, some kid may pick up my book and be inspired the way that I was inspired by H.G. Wells' book and about the book about Einstein and carry on the next step. But I think it will happen. And as I said, I'd like to see the beginning of it, though, in my lifetime.
Okay, let's go back to final calls here, Ron. We'll go to Oakland, California. Robin's been waiting. Hi, Robin. Go ahead.
Well, good evening, George. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you.
Good. And Professor, how are you?
Fine. Thank you. How are you?
I'm doing well, fine now that I have the honor of talking to you both. A couple of things. One of them is I wanted to say you win either way, Professor, on account of when you do die and go home, you get to see your dad. So you do get to see your dad either way, but I love the fact that it's brought you to doing the time machine. What I wanted to ask is, George, can you remember you had someone on the show a little bit ago who spoke about the groups that were present during the World War II. That the professor mentioned, and that the reason that we had not developed the clean energy that it would enable us to travel, interstellar travel, was because the people who had the ability to develop it had been killed in the Holocaust. Do you recall that?
Yes, I think, and I don't recall the guest, though.
I don't either.
Because I have so many.
I know, I don't.
But anyways, go ahead with Ron. Any question?
Well, that was my, basically that was my question, and whether or not the professor knew anything about them, and...
All right, I don't want to answer that for you, Ron. I don't think you do.
No, I don't, as a matter of fact. I you know, George, you're right, I don't know anything about that. I mean, the thing is that, no, I'm not aware of that.
Okay, very good. Robin, thanks, but he does not know. El Paso, Texas, Nancy, east of the Rockies. Hey, good morning, Nancy.
Hi, yes. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
I was wondering, have you thought of some sort of spacesuit? More so like saying like you don't think maybe our DNA or something could happen to our body as we travel through this light. Like I would think it's like a vortex where your matter, your gravity, and you'd be pulling the light towards you where the light could possibly burn you or cut you into pieces. Have you ever thought of like a space?
Well, the thing is that you're quite right. You would stay away from the light beam, okay? You would definitely not want to go into the region. Where you would be involved is the region within the light beam, okay, or outside the light beam, but you would not cross the light beam itself because that would not be a good idea to go through the laser beam. But as far as the vortex itself is concerned, yes, that would sweep you around, and physically it would be uncomfortable. It wouldn't rip you apart, but if the device was constructed properly. But the thing is that you would feel a sort of an unsettling motion when you're going through it, which is an interesting thing. One of the things that when I reread The Time Machine by H.G. Wells, the time traveler talks about having this headless, motion that felt like he was going, you know, into, he was being pulled around. It sounded like he was, it was an unsettling motion that was causing him a sort of a queasiness. Mm-hmm. And that is the sort of thing that you might feel if you're being swept around in the vortex.
Like maybe
your
being
whole body
pulled apart?
Would remain intact.
I'm sorry, like maybe being pulled apart?
No, being pulled around.
Mm.
You know, like you were in a whirlpool.
Mm-hmm. So would you think that you would need, like, a spacesuit?
No, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I don't think that you would need a spacesuit because, I mean, you're thinking of something like a pressurized suit that would keep you from being pulled apart. Is that what you're thinking
or,
about?
or burned by the light itself.
No. The thing is, as I said, you would the machine would be designed in such a way that you would stay away from the light. You know, it would keep you would not get near the light. That would be designed so that you would stay away from the light. So no, that would not be a problem. I mean, if the thing is designed properly.
Okay. One more quick
question. It would be a problem if you got into the light, but as I said, you could design the device in such a way that you could keep yourself away from the light.
Oh, okay. One quick question. I'll let you all go.
Sure.
How long do you think it would take to travel more or less 10 years? Would it take days or like a year? And I'll take this comment offline.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Okay, Ness. Days, years? It would probably not take you any time at all. We would age, right?
Right, we would age. It wouldn't feel like it was taking much time for you because time would be slowing down, even as you're going into the past. For you, it wouldn't take much time to go back. It wouldn't take 10 years for you to go back. And you're actually traveling in space as well as time. You know, that's the other thing. It's you're not just traveling back in time. You're actually traveling long loops in space when you're going back in time. So it's not going to take you the same amount of time to get back to the past as the time that had passed. But other people would see, for them, you would actually have traveled 10 years into the past. But for you, it wouldn't be that same amount of time.
Okay, next up we go to Des Moines, Iowa. Troy, it's your turn on Coast to Coast. Hi, Troy.
Hi, George. Thank you, and to your crew and everybody you have on for continuously opening everybody's minds. My question is, Doctor, I would assume that you've heard of the guy named John Teeter.
John Teeter's a time traveler, supposed time traveler, Ron, from the year 2036.
Yeah, the thing is that, once again, and this is really important, it's something that I tell my students, I say, you know, if someone claims to you that they are a time traveler from the future, you know, be very polite with them. But the first thing to ask them is to show them your machine, their machine, because...
Well, right, you have to realize that's actually my... That was actually my question that I had, because, George, you had the guest on. I can't remember who runs that website, but he has asked people to look at
Oliver Williams.
Pictures of that machine, to look at pictures of that machine and to see if anybody could, you know, differentiate or decipher some of the things that were on it.
Oh, no, see, but that's the other aspect, though, and then you brought up a very, very important point. The thing is that when I say... that showed the machine, what that was just sort of simplification. What I meant was that you should be able to publicly demonstrate your experiment. The experiments, for instance, that I mentioned about the slowing of clocks using the passenger jets, those were public experiments that could be observed by anyone and were reproduced by independent researchers anywhere. So what I mean is not pictures of the device. That's not good enough. In other words, with my work, if people say, you know, Mallet, have you been able to show that you can twist space and time, I would be required by the scientific community to be able to take them into the laboratory and show them that this can be done. Not only that, but based on my calculations, based on my work, they could independently do the same thing. That's what real science is all about. So it can't just simply be pictures or photos or videos. It actually has to be something that can be evaluated by the scientific community independently of the researcher. So unless this person, Teeter or whoever, can actually show to the scientific community that the device, in other words, demonstrated in a laboratory setting, then one has to be skeptical of it, because the fact is that, as I said, the hallmark of science is reproducibility and observability by independent researchers. What's going on at the LHC is something that can be observed by anyone in the scientific community, and even though they may have to have, you know, beam access time, it's something can be reproduced, and something that is not just something that one has to take one's word for, that these are the results that one got for the other researchers are as well, then that's important. It doesn't have to do with this particular person, but with any scientific experiment that says they've gotten certain results.
We had a picture of Charlie Chaplin, one of his movies from the 1920s, and there was a picture of somebody that looked like they were in the background holding a cell phone, and it was quite a buzz, Ron. Everybody thought maybe it was a time traveler.
Oh, no, no. In fact, I was actually interviewed about that on a couple of shows. The thing is that the problem, once again, is you don't know what it is that they're holding. That is, the phrase is anachronistic. That is to say that we, in our future time, are superimposing what we know about a cell phone on something that's happening in another time, and we don't really know at all what that other person has. And as I said, you know, since then, the buzz has been modulated because of the fact that, once again, you know, we have interpreted from our time what's going on in some other time, and if there's no way of actually seeing clearly what it is that person has, then there's no way of sit. And I, just as I said, I don't believe that that person was holding a cell phone. But the thing is that, as I said, from the film, it's not possible to really know what it is. But I do think that we have superimposed our time on their time and interpreted that as a cell phone.
Okay, let's go to our Skype caller, Tony, in Galax, Virginia. Hey, Tony, thanks for calling.
Hey, George, how are you?
Good.
Hey, is your guessing Rob?
Ron. Professor Ron.
Professor Ron. Well, I was going to ask about John Titor, but we've already discussed that. Another quick question I had, I noticed in a lot of time travel movies, they don't discuss this much. I noticed in one episode of Doctor Who, they kind of did. They kind of made a little joke about it, that they don't talk about how they avoid not rematerializing into rocks or trees or mountains or, you know, that kind of thing. I think in the episode that I know of Doctor Who, they did talk about, well, it really wasn't talked about. It was just shown that he appeared in front of a wall and opened the door. He's like, oh, I'm in front of a wall. So he manipulated himself through time back to where the TARDIS was facing in the other direction. So, you know, that was a cute little way of looking at that. So do you have a device in your machine that ensures that doesn't happen?
Oh, yeah. As a matter of fact, it's built into the construction of it, because you can only send signals back or eventually come back to the device itself. And if you build the device in a safe place in a laboratory setting, you're only going to come back to that place. In other words, you have to remember that and this is another thing that's not usually addressed, but the thing is that, you know, we're moving through space, and the device is moving through space with the Earth. And if you're traveling from the future, you're traveling from where the device is in the future, but the device is in the laboratory of the same room in the future, and you're coming back to the same location in the past. So there is never going to be an issue of you materializing into it. If they remember that Doctor Who, and I really think that's a great show too, incidentally. In England, they actually had their daily newspaper had a feature article about me, calling me the real Doctor Who. But the thing is that if they were consistent, his device would always be located at a specific place in the past, and no matter where he was coming from the future, he would always be coming back to that location in the past. But as I said, it's science fiction, so, you know, that's they have to deal with that particular problem. But with a real-time machine, that's not going to be an issue, because you build it in a safe place. Once you turn it on, anyone from the future who's coming back will be coming back to the device at either back where it was turned on or somewhere in between, but it's always going to be in the laboratory location. And as I said, so you're never going to have that as an issue with a real time machine.
Ron, we could probably go on for 20 more hours with the amount of phone calls you're getting here, but we've only got about a minute left, and I want everybody to at least be able to know where to find your book, The Traveler, and also your website for any more information on you. Go ahead.
Yes, right. Well, my book, Time Traveler, A Scientist's Personal Mission to Make Time Travel Reality, is available in paperback from Amazon.com. And for additional information about my work, you can go to the University of Connecticut website, which is www.phys.uconn, and that's spelled UConn.edu. And that will take you to the website. And I think that on your webpage,
yep,
George, you have all
we've
that
got that for you. Absolutely.
So I really appreciate that.
Ron, keep in touch with us and let us know what happens with your time machine.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure being on the program.
It's Dr. Ron Mallett, and a classic when it comes to time travel.